Welcome to Club Clinical, where healthcare providers meet up to talk about all things that propel the culture forward.
I like the sound of that.
What else?
Health, wealth, and all-around self-improvement. This is Club Clinical.
Hey everyone, this is Aisha Allen, your host of Club Clinical. Thank you so much for tuning in again. This podcast episode came at a different time than I had planned. This episode, number two, was going to be something completely different. However, with the current times and the need for immediate change and action and education, and the acknowledgement that clearly the United States has been doing something incorrectly, I have felt it necessary to share my experiences around race and racism, how it has affected me and how it still continues to affect me daily. And this podcast episode is going to do a few things. We're going to talk about a brief history of America and its racist roots that are rooted in white supremacy. And I'm going to tackle and kind of explain where racism has rooted itself and where those branches and the tree has sprouted in all facets of modern day times. And briefly, I want to, again, just make sure that everyone can get something out of this podcast episode and then the subsequent ones coming after this, whether or not you are a Black person in America or someone of color from Africa, a person of color, no matter where you are from, knowing the history of the United States and the country that I live in is very, very important to then be able to understand the current state of events and why people are hurting and why people are angry. Another person or people that can get something out of this are the people who are interested in learning about why people are hurting, the people who are interested in being allies, because it is something that's kind of challenging to understand. I can see truly from the from a different perspective how you could feel confused about this quote unquote sudden uptick in of anger. Granted, it's not sudden. It's been happening for years and years. I still don't know the root of why all of a sudden people are paying attention. Maybe because things are being filmed. But for whatever the reason is, I hope that you and whoever listeners can share this podcast with people who will listen and just listen. Because obviously you can't talk back to me. So I just beg listeners to listen to the entire thing and come back for the other series to follow. All right, so back into slavery. Obviously, we do know that slavery brought Africans to the United States. And for 400 years, 400, four centuries, hundreds of years, Black people were enslaved in the United States. Families were ripped apart, sold from South Carolina to Florida, all up and down the East Coast, really, to be honest, Virginia. And during these 400 years of slavery, Blacks were not allowed to read. It was forbidden to read. At some point in time, Blacks could not get married. The slaves could not get married. Slaves were beaten, obviously, for not meeting quotas for cotton or whatever else their master was having them produce or pick. And so there's 400 years of this. 400 years of telling their sons and their sons and their sons and their daughters that Blacks are not smart, that Blacks are on the earth to serve them. 400 years of the Bible being used as an explanation and a defense of slavery. 400 years of this, you guys. Think about how old you are. I'm 29. I cannot imagine that many years happening of where in which slavery was legal. And when you think about how racism was built, that is the root of it here in America. We're not going to talk about how Africans sold blacks in Africa. We know that. We know that there's slavery still going on, but that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about the slave trade in the transatlantic slave trade that ended with slaves in America, right? So we have wars that were fought over slavery. You have the Union and you have the Confederacy. I'm from Virginia, so I know a lot of U.S. history. So when we have the Confederacy and the Union, Confederacy being the one that is shown and thought of as the Confederate flag, when you really boil things down, things were being fought over business and money, per usual. But the Confederacy wanted to keep slavery around. Otherwise, their economy would collapse. So that's pretty much what the Confederacy was fighting about. So when we think about that, and I can immediately talk about and think about people with a Confederate flag, and you ask them, you know, what is your purpose? And why do you love this flag so much? In African-American and black people's heads, it's still very confusing to us and mind-boggling for people to wave this flag around that they know hurts others and justify it by saying, oh, we support the Southern states. Well, what do the Southern states want? You know? So I want people to think about that as well. All right, now moving on, after 400 years, slavery is supposedly ended. Slavery is outlawed, right? But after the outlaw of slavery, you have what is called the Jim Crow laws. They were a system of codes, specifically, definitely in the South, but also in the North as well, that happened in the post-Civil War era until about 1968, that were meant to pretty much keep African Americans in their place, deny them the right to vote, hold jobs, get an education, buy homes, get loans, start businesses. It goes on for forever. But those who attempted to circumvent or not follow these Jim Crow laws were arrested, fined, put in jail, lynched, hung, beaten, and especially beaten by the cops. Cops historically have been put in place to enforce racist laws. I'll repeat that again. Cops, since slavery, really, were sent to retrieve slaves and bring them back to their masters, sent to overseers of plantations and properties to make sure that slaves were doing their job. Cops have been sent to enforce Jim Crow codes and laws. Cops historically have also had strong foundational roots in the KKK. You guys can replay that again and listen to it. I hope you hear what I'm saying. There are bad cops. There are good cops. But part of this discussion is to include the historical nature of the police and law enforcement and their basis and where a lot of our mistrust comes from. All right, so back to the Jim Crow laws. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to parallel some of the laws to what we are seeing in the manifestation that we see now. And then we're going to dive into the current manifestation that I want to talk about, and that is education, because that has definitely impacted me. And I want you guys to, you know, hear some of my experiences. So when we talk about Jim Crow laws and how African-Americans were segregated in all facets of life, parks, housing, restaurants, buses, theaters, restaurants. I think I just said that. That was enforced, again, one, by cops, but also by the people who ran and owned those spaces, right? The people, the janitors and the managers and the owners and the purveyors and the surveyors and the people who built the houses, oftentimes that were black people building houses in neighborhoods that they were not allowed to live in, but that's beside the point. So those have there's a strong historical factor that I don't want to be lost, is that the general public, not just the police, also enforced and policed these segregation laws as well. So when we talk about, let's go for the housing market, right? And African Americans, after slavery was eradicated, were oftentimes indentured servants, indentured slaves, so to speak. Yes, they were no longer slaves. However, they had no other means of making money than to stay on the plantation, share crop, which means they were still picking the cotton, for example, and getting paid very, very little to do the job that they were already doing. Now, because of the ramifications of slavery, a lot of families were also broken up, right? So we think about now what we see as a broken home in the Black community. Where did that start? That started during slavery, where families and mothers and kids and fathers were broken up and split and sent to different plantations. Slavery is a huge founding piece of all the things that we are seeing being coughed up right now in current manifestations. All right, let's talk about housing a little bit more. When we think about how after leaving the plantation and wanting to get out of the South because of the segregation and the harassment and the beatings and the lynchings, people were driven to move to only certain areas that they were allowed to live in, what we now see as the projects. We currently see a manifestation of segregation in the form of the projects and Blacks and low-income people being driven to certain areas that they can afford as to keep them out of the rich, affluent, previously white neighborhoods. All right, let's talk about voting. It's a big one because it's still happening today. African Americans were disenfranchised for years. They were not allowed to vote. There were so many different codes put in place so that African Americans could not vote unless they had land or vote unless they had a certain amount of money. That's happening right now. People are still having their right to vote taken away. Literacy tests being thrown, put on the table to happen before you can vote. It's ridiculous to me that we honestly still don't see the parallels, but that's why I'm taking the time right now to take the time and educate and just pretty much bring the history to the forefront. Let's talk about the KKK and again with the police and the policing. The KKK has its roots, and I think one of the major headquarters was in Danville, Virginia. And I've talked about that in probably a later podcast. That was one of the places I went to clinical in. It was a secret society that was terrorizing Black people and communities and was very, very pervasive in the white culture and was not just normal people. The KKK members were police officers. They were judges. They were in the government. They were very, very, very high up, and they were lawyers. They were in all facets of our population in our cities. Those things just don't disappear, you guys. There are people who are still members of the KKK that are lawyers and whatever. They're not all dead. I really want people to think about that. Just because we had a Black president doesn't mean anything. Yes, it's great. We had our first Black president, but this stuff is still going on. All right, now I'm going to really tackle, and there's so much more that I could talk about in regard to Jim Crow. I could go on, but I want to really move forward to the civil rights era and the civil rights movement. Because after the Jim Crow laws, and actually enduring, obviously, Blacks were tired of it, just like we're tired now. They were tired of it then. They wanted fair treatment. In ushered the civil rights era. A lot of people just know it as, you know, MLK and Malcolm X, and people love to throw out the MLK, Martin Luther King quotes, right? But put yourself in during that time period. Martin Luther King was one of the most hated men when he was alive. So when I see white Americans quoting MLK now to justify, current racism, essentially, it makes me want to puke, honestly, because the same people that are justifying the killings and the murderings of Black people are the same people that are throwing out MLK quotes as some type of supportive justice. So when we talk about the civil rights era, and we see that African Americans had had enough, and they were protesting, they were burning, they were rioting in response to their homes being gassed and bombed, and their friends and family members being hung in the streets, hanging. Listen to the song Strange Fruit by Nina Simone, y'all. That's what she's talking about, bodies hanging in the street. People being just lynched and hung and with nooses around their neck, bodies rotting in the streets. Black people were tired of that. Look at Emmett Till, a 12-year-old Black boy that was murdered because a white woman said that he looked at her. That woman later on said that she was lying. And when you fast forward now to 2020, a few days ago, we have someone in Central Park calling the police saying that she was threatened. So why are Black people mad? We're mad because it's still happening and it's deadly. It was deadly then. It is still deadly now. All right. Going back into the civil rights era, protesting in restaurants, sitting in the front, sitting where we weren't allowed to, drinking out of the water fountains where we're not allowed to, sitting in the front of buses when we were not allowed to. And I have my own opinion on this now, and I'll briefly share it. I think we did ourselves a little disservice fighting to sit at a table where we were not wanted, fighting to be integrated into a system that was not built for us, because now look where we are. But that's beside the point. Now, one of the things that I really want to get into and tackle is the education piece of this all, from slavery until now, and how it has impacted me today. And then after that, we're going to get into a little bit of what I faced at Duke University's nurse anesthesia program. So when we look at the history of slavery and education, slaves were not allowed to read or write. They're not allowed to have books. That was not allowed for African Americans, Black slaves, to be educated. That is the core and the foundation of the educational mistreatment of Blacks in this country. So you take it a little further, and you have someone here and there teaching people how to read and to write, and you have Frederick Douglass, and you have people putting out works, finally, about the plight of slavery. But then you have Jim Crow, where, you know, segregation was still allowed and actually enforced until, you know, Ruby Bridges, and you can look her up, was escorted to desegregate the first school. She was 6 years old. And if you look up Ruby Bridges, you are going to see images of her protesters, people who protested a six-year-old Black girl and she was being escorted by cops. They were protesting the desegregation of public schools. And if you look at those pictures of the kids and the mothers and the daughters and the kids that were holding signs given to them by their parents, white women holding a casket with a Black baby in it, screaming the rage on their face. Google these images, you guys. Please Google these images. Ruby Bridges, I believe, is now 68. So the kids that were protesting her are still alive, just like she's still alive. And where are those people right now? Where are those kids that were holding up signs against her desegregating a school? Where are they now? They are alive and well and present. They are the chiefs of police. I've said this before. They're the chiefs of police. They are the surgeons. They are the doctors. They are your grandparents, your uncle's best friend. The one that comes to the dinner table at Christmas and says some really racist stuff. The lawyers. The person at the rental office. The bankers. The person that is going to accept or deny your loan. Still here, you guys. They're still here telling their children not to date Black people because what? Black people are inferior. Where does that come from? That comes from slavery. Black people are not educated. Where does that come from? Slavery. All of these things that I'm talking about, and I'm going to get into the education portion in just a second, have its base and its foundation in slavery, But further, let's go really call what it is. It's white supremacy. The notion and idea that white is better, white is right. White supremacy I'm really feeling it, you guys, but white supremacy is the ground that these racist trees have been planted in. And these trees have become very, very fruitful and dropped its fruit in all different segments of society. I hope that analogy makes sense. It makes sense to me. But we are seeing the fruit, and people are eating this fruit, this racist fruit. And it has infected our culture like a virus. So now let's get into the education part of it and how it has impacted me. So when we think about education and how schools had to be desegregated, and once schools were desegregated and Black people were finally allowed to go to these schools, we were obviously not being treated fairly, right? So in comes HBCUs, or historically Black colleges. So when you fix your mouth to say, and I've heard this so many times, why are there Black colleges? Isn't that racist? No, it's not racist, because for many, many years, Blacks were not allowed to attend white schools. And for the purposes of this, I want to delineate and draw attention to two acronyms that I will use is PWI, which is predominantly white institution, and HBCU, or historically Black college or university. Now, historically Black colleges, HBCUs are still around. You know, you have Howard University. My mom went to Howard. You have a bunch of throughout the country, Spelman, and, you know, look them up. These institutions are amazing and create amazing humans to go out in the world and further educate. But don't forget and don't let that be lost upon you as to why they were created. So now insert, you know, whatever year it is where African-Americans and Blacks, whatever term you want to call it, I'll say Black, are now allowed to go and attend these schools and suffer mistreatment. Now, let's take a picture or a page out of, you know, what I was previously talking about in slavery. And I can talk to you now about my experiences at Duke University. So we're now allowed to go to these schools, but obviously we're not welcome, right? So there are things that happen on campuses to make Black people uncomfortable, make Black people know that they are unwanted. Now, let's talk about the entire institution. For example, let's use Duke University. It's in the South, North Carolina, right? Do you think that the people who were running Duke at the time, the deans and the presidents during the desegregation era, were cool with African Americans coming to their schools? In fact, let me actually tell you the year that the first five African Americans came. So at this point, I think there may be either two or three surviving members of what Duke University called the first five. And in 2018, because I'm reading from my document, it definitely is probably different in different years, but they were the first Black students at Duke University. And I want you guys to look up that year, because it's actually not that far gone. And these people had to desegregate the University of Duke. Like, I can't imagine what that was like. And they were met with just horrible, horrible stuff. Obviously racism and people not wanting them to be there and being aggressive toward them, and teachers making it challenging for them to get good grades and assuming that they are dumb and stupid and not letting them join clubs, certainly not letting them go to medical school there, because that wasn't allowed either. Hanging nooses from trees. Now, you guys heard me previously talk about, you know, bodies hanging from trees and listening to that song by Nina Simone. And can you imagine walking on campus as a Black student during that time and seeing nooses hanging from the trees for people to remind you of that? Well, let me tell you that in, I think, 2016, a noose was found on Duke University's campus in 2016. Now, if you go and you look up noose, North Carolina, slaves hanging, you are going to see images of Black bodies hanging from a tree. Now, imagine being a Black student during desegregation or during 2016? What are you reminded of? You're reminded that stepping on that campus, you are not welcome. Let me show you what we think of you. Let's put this noose up in North Carolina. Let's remind you. Also happening at Duke in the words nigger lover scribbled on the front door of a black student. When I started at Duke, August 26th of 2017, I believe, the Center for Black Culture, the day before school started, the word nigger was scrawled across the Center for Black Culture, black being crossed out. So it said Center for Nigger Culture. This is when I was on campus, you guys. Now, me being more of an adult at that time, I do realize that these things are being coughed up all the time. But can you imagine being a new freshman on the campus, being excited to go to Duke University and seeing that on the place where you're supposed to seek refuge and be comfortable, the Center for Black Culture, someone defaced it and wrote nigger culture. And what do the universities do? They say that it's free speech. Yes, they say that it's free speech and that nothing can be done. So then you are seeing your school immediately, in a way, uphold white supremacy. Not in a way, it is. You are upholding and allowing the white supremacy tendencies through the form of racism to be upheld. I know a lot of people like to use these terms, microaggression, macroaggression. No, it's just aggression. It's aggression towards Black people, Black students, and it's damaging. So when you, as a student, I'll speak to myself because that's what we're talking about. You have this history, and I'm not going to talk about my educational history. Actually, I'll briefly talk about it. Like, as a child, you know, I was smart. I was gifted. I got 100% on everything. In first grade, I'll never forget my teacher assuming that I cheated and moving me outside of my classroom for me to take a test. Now, if you guys have heard me on Instagram, you know I talk about my mom, and my mom doesn't play. If you see me, that's her. So can you imagine me coming home and telling my mom that my first grade teacher sat me outside to take a test? My mom set her straight. Lynn Murphy, what's up? She set her straight, let her know that, because my mom knew immediately what this was about. You know, I told my mom, yeah, she moved me around the room. Because as a kid, you don't really know. So you move me around the room, mom. But that's me in first grade starting to deal with that. In first grade, teachers telling me that my hair is inappropriate in braids. Why, as a kid, is my hair inappropriate in braids? To whom? And why do you feel so comfortable commenting on my hair? Let's fast forward that to now, me entering Duke University simulation room in the nursing assistantship program. And my clinical education coordinator's there saying, oh, how are you going to fit your afro in a scrub cap? That reminded me immediately, and that was very, very early on, where it let me know, like, oh, okay, I see where I'm at right now. For you to comment on that. Something I always got also growing up is, oh, you don't sound like an Aisha. What does that mean, guys? Why? Because I have a command of the English language? Because you're shocked that I can speak English? Where does that idea come from that I can't speak English? Oh, I know. White supremacy and slavery. So I hope you guys are seeing the parallels that I'm drawing from slavery and white supremacy to how they show up now, right? And let me really, really tell you guys and show you guys how they showed up for me at Duke University nursing anesthesia program in one of the biggest, biggest ways that I still kind of feel affected by. Let's get into the recordings. I want to preface all the recordings that you are going to hear by saying that this was not something that I ever thought I would have to do at my university, that I intentionally chose for a few reasons. But I had known early on through interactions with different faculty members that I was going to be treated differently. especially by one of the members of this entire thing. I will never forget initially being taken aback when during simulation, she asked me how I could fit my hair in a scrub cap and how I was going to do that for clinical. Or in an eval that I have copy of saying, I didn't expect you to be so professional. So dealing with that and knowing and hearing those things immediately and understanding the tone of the emails that I received from a few individuals, but one in particular, I knew that I was not safe and that my only protection was to record myself. And where I was, it was a one-person consent state, meaning that only one person had to know that a recording was taking place. And so I legally did that as a way to protect myself. And here we are now, because after all of the different things that I went through at Duke University, I went through the proper channels. I addressed people within the nurse anesthesia program. I went to the ombudsman. I went to the Office of Student Affairs, the Office of Diversity and Inclusion for the entire institution, and multiple times. And immediately also knew that my voice, one, for a few, either they didn't care or my voice just didn't matter enough for them to do anything about it. So nothing ever came of out of me going to the proper avenue. So here we are now, and I have a voice. I'm not scared to use it. I'm not afraid of them not graduating me. I'm not afraid of them putting me in different clinical sites where they know are challenging. So yeah, that's where we are now. So happy listening.
Hi.
Hey, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Good. Let's go down here for just a second. Let's talk about that.
How are you?
Hey.
Hi.
Hi.
How are you?
Good.
Good to see you.
So, Aisha, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So, I know you don't know why we're here. Morgan is away this week.
Oh.
He would be here, not me.
Oh, okay.
So, you want to start?
Sure.
We received a notification, and it voiced some concerns about some things that were overheard.
A little context for the beginning part of this, of what you heard. I was told on a Sunday afternoon that I needed to meet with one of the voices that you heard in the morning. I was initially told, you know, that a meeting needed to happen, and that day, it's a Monday. Mondays, we typically had journal club around 11, and generally the rest of the day, unless previously scheduled, was free. Now, the day before, I had already scheduled appointments, and so to be told that I had a meeting the next day and not told what the meeting was about when I asked, I was not willing to cancel my appointments, and that did not really go well. I was pretty much essentially told that I needed to be in the office at a certain time. So I'm going in there not knowing what the meeting is about, but this was par for course with Duke University's nurse anesthesia program, kind of eliciting some type of fear and not letting you know what you were being reprimanded for. Because that's essentially what would happen anytime, mostly, at least for me, when I was emailed by said instructor. So I am thinking that I'm just meeting with one. And so when I enter the room, you can hear, I literally step across the threshold and she says, oh, actually we're meeting in another office. So if you really pay attention to the beginning of that clip, you can hear how everyone's kind of really jovial and smiling. Hey, hi, do you know so-and-so? Knowing whole time. So I really want you guys to pay attention to that.
The terminology used and
who's the
well, we're not going to know who that was, but the person did think enough they signed their name. So it was not anonymous. It's not okay. someone affiliated with the program, mm-hmm. to my knowledge.
No.
But they had a concern, and they really sounds like they contemplated whether or not to reach out to us.
Okay.
Said it was at the beginning of June. It doesn't specify when, but it was in Wilmington. Says she's a nurse, and she overheard a conversation that you were having with someone talking about the weekend, saying it was going to be a crazy weekend. She did identify your name and that you were 3 semesters from graduation. That's pretty specific.
Mm-hmm.
So I hope that you understand that, I mean, we have an obligation as a program. We have an obligation when we have something as serious as this that
yeah.
really identifies you by name and by your, you know, the point that you are in
yeah.
the program. We have an obligation to follow up on
yeah.
that. So that's why you're here. That's
yeah.
why we're talking about it. And
yeah.
that's why we're asking you
mm-hmm.
for your
mm-hmm.
perspective.
No, and I appreciate that. But I have to strongly say that I wouldn't be talking about that.
Let me just, you know, reiterate and set the mood for you. In the room at this time was not my program director, not my assistant program director, but my clinical education coordinator. Correct. And exact. Pay attention to that. And the head of the doctorate of nursing practice at Duke University School of Nursing. That's who I was in the room with. Again, I thought I was just meeting with the CEC, but was shuffled from the CEC's office to the other office of the director of the the director of the DNP program at Doosan. So during this time, and you, as you've heard, you know, oh, we're not accusing you, but I for damn sure felt like I was being interrogated by the police. After, you know, giving my answer and, you know, I said what I said, you're still asking me questions. Now, at this point in time, I already felt the energy, even though, you know, I was getting the smiles and the okie dokes when I entered the room, I immediately knew that this was not going to be how it went. So I start crying. I'm upset. I'm scared. I immediately know exactly what the heck this is. I'm being profiled. And then kind of, you know, moving on, when we're talking about, you know, oh, we're not accusing you. This is, you know, we are meant to do this and we're supposed to do this. And we're talking about this person has, when you hear them say this person was willing to sign their name and we received a notification, or they have really succinct descriptors of you. And I immediately knew, like, you know, I'm being targeted. I am being profiled because, again, I was one of 25 Black people. I was one of 25 as a Black person in my program. So it was just me. So who the heck else were you talking about when you say my name is, again, at this point in time, I did not see a copy of this because I was told that I couldn't have a copy of it. And as you heard, I was also told that they wouldn't tell me who wrote the letter. We'll talk about that at a later time. So I, you know, am listening to these things and becoming one, very, very scared, but also realizing the fact that someone took time out of their day in life to write what I thought to be a letter at this time to my program. And as you will listen and hear a little bit in just a moment, while my instructors thought that I wasn't being targeted and that they weren't accusing me, obviously I was being accused of something. Otherwise, this wouldn't have happened.
Well, we have an obligation to ask you for a drug test.
Okay.
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 You know, again, this is part of the school policy, and basically you guys have to provide drug testing
mm-hmm.
for these kinds of situations. And we also want to ask you, have you talked to CAPS? I did talk to them. Okay. And so they're going to have, we're going to take you over and have a drug screen. Okay. And then ask you to go to CAPS. And I did talk with CAPS, okay. And they said they handle things. You know what CAPS is? The counseling for safety.
Yeah.
So essentially it's free counseling for students.
Okay.
It's a free resource to you. But that's something that we're going to request that you do, require that you do.
Okay.
So after the drug test, we're going to require that you go to CAPS. And then I did talk with them. They said that it's on a walk-in basis, so they don't, that she does not have to have an appointment.
Okay.
They cannot tell us anything that you disclose to them. However, I need you to sign a release form that will allow us to know that you did or did not attend.
Okay.
So that requires your signature for a release of just that one piece of information that you did not attend.
Okay.
So that.
Yeah, we have, I mean, we, you know, we don't assume, you know, that you've done this,
That's right.
We also can't ignore this, you know.
Okay.
And so the purpose of sending you to CAPS is to have a confidential conversation, either about how this, you know, just about the fact that I know that this is going to be a very stressful day for you, okay,
yeah.
But also, you know, to talk about anything else, you know, we worry that, you know, if this were true, that of course these are very dysfunctional ways of coping, you know, and that, you know, sort of as a just in case, okay.
Can I, I'd like to speak to my mom on the phone before I do anything, and talk to her before I go anywhere.
All right.
And I'd like to, yeah, I'd like to discuss everything with her. Thank you.
You have your phone?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'll sit outside. Sorry?
Just leave it halfway or just tip,
yeah. I want it to be a private call.
Okay.
All
right. Go ahead.
Yeah.
All right, so re-listening to this, it just reminds me of all the things that are so wrong with this scenario. For example, nothing about my clinical abilities were talked about in this supposed letter that was sent to faculty, right? So if my clinical experience was not talked about, which I know it was not because I think I received one negative clinical evaluation throughout my entire time during school. And at this particular site, actually, the week before that, I had a preceptor send this woman, my clinical education coordinator, an email saying how well and how wonderful I was doing at this clinical site. So for my clinical site and my performance not to be mentioned, one, there's no reason for my clinical education coordinator to be there. So why are you there? Why are we having this discussion with the doctorate, the DNP director? You are refusing to tell me who wrote this letter or whatever it is. And you are questioning me about a letter from someone that you have just received blankly. At this point in time, and I'm going to kind of spoiler alert, no research had been done. No one was contacted. No one was called. Just a piece of paper received and me called into the office and then me being taken to be escorted to have a drug test done. Yeah. Even just thinking about it is crazy to me. I was escorted to take a drug test around the hospital that I trained at, and then escorted to go to a mandatory counseling and psychological services meeting on a Monday. And I had no idea that any of this was going on. But I'm just gonna, you know, hop to it, and I want to really pull up this letter and let you guys know what the letter said, and then ask you guys to maybe you guys can help me. I'm not sure. So in this letter, from Rachel Nguyen, spelled N-G-U-Y-E-N, from the email, yeah, not a letter, email, rcnguyen.85@gmail.com, sent Thursday, June 14th, 2018, at 12:38 p.m. Mind you, again, that the meeting that I had was on Monday, the 18th. Sent to, not a program director, not assistant program director, not the clinical education coordinator, not any of the faculty. Sent to someone that handles the ins and outs of the daily affairs, the emails and the signings and getting people ready for clinical. Not to any of those other people I was talking about. And the subject, Duke CNRA student. Yeah, CNRA. It says, good morning. I have contemplated writing this email many times, unsure if it's my place to say anything, as it is still on my mind and I have reached out to my mentors on what to do. I have made the decision to write this email. I did not know who to address it to. I chose to reach out to you due to your title on the Duke website. At the beginning of June, I was visiting a friend in Wilmington and found myself next to a Duke CNRA student. As a RN myself, contemplating my future career path, I was intrigued in her conversation she was having with a few others on the beach about your program and her clinical site. As I decided to get up to introduce myself, the conversation seems to go somewhere that was quite concerning. There was talk about illicit drug use and a plan for a crazy weekend. I'm uncertain how much truth the conversation held. But as a fellow medical professional, I found the conversation very upsetting and concerning. I made the comparison that being under the influence at school would be the same as if I walked onto shift under the influence. It is unsafe and unprofessional. As healthcare professionals, as nurses and student nurses, we directly affect patients. Again, I don't know how much truth this conversation held. And this is all in bold, by the way, this paragraph. Again, I don't know how much truth this conversation held or if there were truly any CRNA program at Duke. All I caught was her introducing herself to others as Aisha/Alicia. She was graduating in 3 more semesters, spelled S-O-M-E-S-T-E-R-S, and was African American. I'm sorry to be emailing you this, but after returning home, I found myself at work after a clinical emergency, wondering about her and her patients. Thank you for your time, Rachel Nguyen. Yeah, so that's the letter that they received. And as you guys listened to prior, the terms that were used to describe me initially that I was told to during that meeting did not include African American. That was something I found out after I got my hands on this letter. And that's where we'll stop today, you guys, because I think there's a few more episodes out of this because I need to dig into all the things that are wrong about this date and the time and the spelling and the effects and affects. But that'll be at a different time. For now, thank you so much for sticking with me, for supporting me, for allowing me to use my voice. Yes, it's scary sometimes, but I know that right now, during all of this, this needs to be said because there are so many people that look like me around the country, but specifically at Duke University, dealing with what I dealt with. So if I can make a change somehow, I will. And after all of this, I want people to pay attention to the response and what happens. What happens between for me and with the institution? What will be the response? Will it be, oh, we need to change, or a condemnation? And so thank you for tuning in, and we'll be back next week. Bye, guys.